मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Hi and welcome to episode 110 of Attention Plus with Arnab Ray. We are recording on the 13th of December 2020. I am Vikram Mohan, asking you to check out other podcasts from Forspire at forspire.net. That's the number 4, S-P-I-R-E.net. But you know that, of course. So let's get your host in, Arnab. Hey, Arnab.
Hello. Hello, everybody. I hope you guys are doing well. I want to start off with that we're going to have our Ask Me Anything for my birthday, which is at the end of this month. So if you have any questions, and I've already gotten a lot of questions, send them over Twitter using the hashtag AskArnabRay. Important that we have the Ray.
Yes, which actually brings me to my first question. I mean, now that your namesake is coming to your turf and starting a Bengali channel, is West Bengal big enough for the two of you?
I think it is. I think it is. I don't know what the strategy of Republic is going to be in Bengal. I would presume that it's not going to be Arnab Goswami who's also going to, because right now he does English and Hindi, right?
So I've actually not seen Hindi, but does he do Hindi regularly? Always?
I'm not sure.
I don't watch
either. I don't know if he does Hindi regularly, but he definitely does.
He does it. Yes, at least during the election once.
No, that Riya Chakravarti druggy hai, that's Hindi, right?
Right, so, drugs do, that one.
Yeah, drugs do. I think he leaves his total deranged rants for Hindi. I think that he tries to keep English slightly classy. When I say classy, I mean on by the Arnab Goswami scale. But I think that Hindi is where he really, like where the proverbial rubber hits the road for Arnab Goswami. That's when he
I'm assuming he speaks Bengali.
I don't know if he speaks Bengali. I think his Bengali might be stilted. So I honestly don't, firstly, I don't know how you'll have time to go to super prime time on three different different languages.
But you got to think, at least for the opening, maybe he will, you know.
I mean, this is at this point of time, I mean, this is like McKinsey level multitasking at this point of time. If he's going to be doing all three of them. And I really can't see the channel taking off unless it's him. I just don't think that you can bring in, it's like, you see, Republic is like a circus. It's like a circus. And if you don't have your if you don't have your headline clown or lion, whatever you want to believe he is, but if you don't have your headliner in the circus venue at any city, then obviously people are not going to come to see it.
I mean, nobody's going to watch Queen without Freddie Mercury.
Yes, so I don't understand what the strategy is going to be, unless it's going to be Arnab Goswami himself. I haven't seen anybody on there in Republic who can take over even Republic for a while. Like, for instance, it's not Bhandari Bolo 300, though. I don't think it's even, quote unquote, Bhandari can even do that. So I just don't think that there'll be anybody who will be kind of holding the fort in Republic while Arnab Goswami goes to conquer the land of Bengal. I don't think that's going to happen either.
Let me ask you this then. Is there any anti-government channel or TMC channel currently in West Bengal?
There is. Now, I'm not particularly, the names escape me because these channels are all new. So they all sprung up after I left India. So there are a few. So when I was more intimately connected with Bengal politics, this was when the Sikh Communist Party of India, CPM, was ruling mostly. At that point of time, Anandabazar Patrika was seen to be anti-establishment. So Anandabazar Patrika, which runs Telegraph, was seen to be anti-establishment, and there was a significant amount of friction between Jyoti Basu's government and Anandabazar Patrika. There's a Bengali newspaper called Anandabazar, which is by far the most read Bengali daily. I mean, every Bengali family would have an Anandabazar. So this was, Telegraph was mostly you know, elite people who wanted to see. In those days, you know, Telegraph used to carry like sexy pictures by 90s standards. Like they would have a issue called Bond Girls. So the Sunday magazine would have Bond Girls. And all my friends would wake up to see that for some reason, the magazine had not been delivered that day.
Right.
Their parents took it and like, you know, kept it in their almirah for later viewing. So this was what Telegraph was usually considered slightly sleazy. Nowadays, of course, Telegraph is the vanguard of, you know, intellectualism and like speaking truth to power. But this was a different Telegraph, different days. And Ananda Bazar Patrika was pretty much against the CPM government. That was given. It was not so much against CPM government. It was again an anti-establishment stance. In those days, anti-establishment did not necessarily mean sitting in Calcutta and being anti-establishment in Delhi. It meant being anti-establishment to the establishment that really mattered, which is the local state government. Now, over the years, I have heard that there are some channels which are, by the way, Ananda Bazar Patrika, the ABP group ABP. Is now totally a Trinamool house. Okay. After Abhik Sarkar left, it is now not so when they started off, Mamata Banerjee and all these people became very pissed off at Telegraph. I think there was at point of time a diktat that no Ananda Bazar Patrika, any period, anything they publish should not be in any government libraries. So, which again wouldn't have really hurt them, but it was more a symbolic thing that you're our enemy. Then, of course, they made a pivot to, you know, essentially becoming a propaganda rag for Trinamool Congress, because they obviously realized that this is the side on which the toast is buttered. So at this point of time, I don't think there is any big reach pro-BJP news organization in Bengal. I mean, there might be some local channels. I think BJP's main way of getting their message across has been through WhatsApp groups. That's what I've heard. Big WhatsApp groups in the backwaters of Bengal. That has really been, and of course, when you have a WhatsApp group, you can say whatever you want there. And you might think, WhatsApp do versus a news channel? No, I mean, WhatsApp is a lot of reach, a huge amount of reach, and people inherently believe whatever shit they get on WhatsApp. So it's not that the BJP doesn't have a means of getting their message out. As a matter of fact, I think from what I've read, Mamata Banerjee and all these people are alarmed at the amount of social media reach that Mamata Banerjee, that BJP has. I mean, Mamata Banerjee might have newspapers, but you know, who reads newspapers nowadays? So that's what they're more concerned about. I don't necessarily think that the BJP needs Republic TV at this point of time, but it wouldn't hurt. I'm pretty sure
it's probably just to do chugli, right? I mean, just to distract Mamata and.
I think it is. I think it's definitely. I mean, why would? So let's just look at it then from this point of view. Why would a news channel go? I mean, I understand the Republic TV wants to make money. If this was purely a capitalist venture, which is wants to maximize profit, you know, going to Bengal is never a good strategic idea for maximizing profit in anything, unless you are, I don't know, want to make Vinal Sen clone movies about famines. Other than that, there is no really big business opportunity in Bengal. I mean, we don't spend a lot. We don't earn a lot. That's why we don't spend a lot. So I would think that it would make more business sense to go to, let's say, you know, Andhra Pradesh, Telangana, Tamil Nadu.
Would you believe it? There are more Telugu news channels than entertainment channels.
I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, that's where the money is. That's where I believe that if I was an investing person, I would definitely put my money there if I was investing in media. But obviously coming to Bengal, which is like the barren wasteland for business, it means that Arnab Goswami isn't here for making money. He's basically here as a crusader. He's here to carry the flag of Amit Shah and Modi ji. And he will be compensated in the afterlife, so as to say. So he's not looking at what he can get out of it right now. So this is obviously not a business decision. This is obviously a political decision. This is BJP's push for Bengal, the last castle, I would say. It's like Sauron's last stand. I think he's just amassing. I think at this point of time, BJP is just amassing the full might of its machinery And I think that Arnab Goswami is a part of that. It's a part of that machine. And they're unleashing. They're like unleashing the Kraken literally on Mamata Banerjee right now. If they, yes, but that's what I'm saying.
That, you make it to one of the boxes in their, one of the 25 boxes.
Yes, I think in order for, that brings me to the first point, that in order for the Kraken to be unleashed, it has to be Arnab Goswami. It can't be some other, you know, lousy person with just a Republic logo behind him. I mean, that's not unleashing the Kraken. That's a bait and switch. And that's not going to help them. If they have to really shake the gates, then they need to send out their Urukai with the right. Stone. That has to be Arnab Goswami. You can't have somebody who used to run a news channel in Bengal, gets, you know, a few lakhs more and comes over to Republic TV. I mean, you don't want a Venky Mysore kind of guy, you know, a lack of passion, you know, that kind of, you know, he'd look at him and he'd think,
you need the veins bulging and
corporate nut. You look at Venky Mysore and I just like, this guy feels no passion for the game at all. I want somebody in Republic TV Bengali who oozes passion and violence, and you'll sit and you'll thump the table, and he will use Bengali swear words. I want news channel to move to using more swear words, and I think this is a good place to start. You want to start out with saying, you know Bengali street vulgarities, which I think that Hindi street vulgarities have kind of made it into the mainstream thanks to the Kunal Kamras of the world and the Anurag Kashyaps of the world. But Bengali street vulgarities have not made it to mainstream. It's still, oh my God, he used that word. It's still a lot of that. And even though street language, it's like street language anywhere else, but that street language hasn't really broken through. Like, for instance, as an example, if the street language, every few words you use the word bara, which means a cock. So it's like saying fucker, like, you know, it's like that. So it doesn't mean anything actually. But I've never seen any kind of popular culture artifact. And maybe I'm not listening to the right things, but I haven't heard any popular culture artifact which actually sounds realistic. The way they talk, nobody talks like that.
Now that you mention it, I mean, through just pop culture, I probably know a couple of swear words in most Indian languages. And yes. I just realized I didn't know anything in Bengali.
What? You don't know anything in Bengali? Then that means you haven't had Bengali friends, because virtually everybody in India knows the word Boka Chodha.
Which,
after Rabindranath Tagore, Boka Chodha. These are the only two things about Bengal that pretty much everybody knows. And so I think, yeah, that's why you would know that. I think I mentioned this before on a podcast that there was a website called bokachoda.com. So this was, in case I haven't mentioned it, maybe I should not do regular programming and talk a little bit about bokachoda.com. So bokachoda.com, believe it or not, was one of the earliest, as I'm saying, mid-90s to late 90s websites. That in those days, where there were very few Indian websites and virtually no Bengali websites, suddenly there was a website called bokachoda.com. And bokachoda.com was run by a Marwari guy. This was later revealed. Of course, it was a pseudonym. I mean, he didn't write under his real name. So bokachoda.com was basically a blog, essentially, where this guy would rant against Bengalis and the Communist Party of India, Marxist. So basically, the central thesis was that all Bengalis were Boka Chodas, and there is no other greater encapsulation of the Boka Chodaness of the typical Bengali than the Communist Party of India. And the person who ran the website was perhaps, I don't know what the trivia of it is, but possibly the first person in India ever to be arrested based on content that they posted online.
Oh, wow.
Because this happened in, say, 97 or something. And that's when the guy was arrested and people came to know who he was. Before that, nobody knew. And again, it's not that a lot of people read it. There was no social media. If it was now, first of all, he would have been arrested within hours. And second is that he would have also been massively viral. But you know, that's the history of the word bokachoda. I don't think bokachoda, no, anybody has ever started anything based on bokachoda after that. But surprisingly, bokachoda.com was one of the first. I mean, there were only two things that I used to read when it came to pure insanity in those days. One was bokachoda.com and one was swordoftruth.com. Ironically, Sword of Truth was run by a Bengali and bokachoda.com was not run by a Bengali. Hated by somebody who hated Bengalis. And Sword of Truth, for those of you who don't know, was this ultra-right-wing, extreme conspiracy, like bizarro. I think some of the WhatsApp forwards that nowadays you get, for instance, I'm sure people have heard of that Jawaharlal Nehru was a Muslim, that thing. You know, there's this Jawaharlal Nehru was a Muslim WhatsApp forward that circulates. That actually came from, that was, you know, nobody knows the source. I know the source where that came from. That is an article from Sword of Truth. This was a guy who used to write, this was a Bengali guy based in the US who used to write this absolutely hate-mongering, like, crazy shit that this guy used to write. So, for instance, for Jawaharlal Nehru, there was an article in which he wrote Jawaharlal Nehru. Whenever he used to mention the word Nehru, he used to write in bracket, now a dog in Sweden.
Because yes, you mentioned this. Yes.
Because apparently some Guruji had said that Nehru had been reborn as a dog in Sweden, of all places, which means that he must have done something good to be born as a dog in Sweden, I guess. Yes. Which is, I guess a good place to be born in general. Because it's a rich country with good public support system. So he's a dog. So Nehru was always like prefixed with dog, now a dog in Sweden. So you can imagine, and it also had in those days. And in that respect, I think it was very forward looking. It had animated GIFs of Shah Rukh Khan in those days, and with the animated GIF would say, "My heart is in Pakistan." There used to be a rotating animated GIF when you came to the front page. One was Arundhati Roy saying, "I want to destroy India." One was Shah Rukh Khan saying, it was my web analog of Gunda. So it was so terrible that I was fascinated by it.
Wow. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to derail you. I mean, I know you've taken a significant detour, but yeah, you wanted to start off actually with talking about too much democracy.
Yes. So again, that's fine. I mean, there's since we just hurriedly put this together, you know, I haven't had chance to think of whatever, but this was good fun. But and one thing before I start off, you know, sometimes I Google myself as because of course I'm an arrogant narcissist person, and I found that according to Google, my affiliation is Dhirubhai Ambani Engineering that Institute. I don't know why they think that I work there. I'm pretty sure that somehow I'm guessing that Dhirubhai Ambani has acquired me, and I haven't gotten the check. So just like everything else, I have been bought over by Ambani, apparently, by Google. Google thinks so. I have no idea. I mean, I know what happens. There's another guy called Arnab Ray who teaches in the Dhirubhai Ambani Institute of Technology.
Oh, okay.
And and Google's machine learning has decided that I am the same person. So, anyways, so we had Amitabh Khan, Khan, saying that we have too much democracy, and apparently he said it, and then he said he didn't say it, even though he was caught on video saying it. And honestly, I don't understand what's the big deal about it also. I think it's a very, very valid point to make. I would, rather than starting off with Amitabh Kant, I would want to start off with my father. So many years ago, somebody, my father was having, there was a discussion. And obviously, these discussions were all, these were all like triggered by the Marxists in Calcutta, Marxist economists. You're saying, you know, why can't Bengal catch up with, why can't India catch up with, you know, China? China is, you know, massively growing in all factors of human growth in industry. And my father's retort to it was, well, the difference between China and India is that China doesn't have to deal with communists. That's actually a great, such a great and very pithy condensation of what the major problem is. The problem is that China does not have to put up with dissent. China can do things which a country like India cannot. It's paradox. The paradox is that China is a communist country, and the biggest impediments to success anywhere else are the communists. But once the communists get into power, they then are like ultra mega capitalists and authoritarians. So the thing about China is that they don't have to worry about labor unions. They don't have to worry about worker conditions. They don't have to worry about lockouts or strikes. I mean, they'll just shoot them. That's all. So of course they don't have to worry about these things that India does. So when what Amitav Kant meant by too much democracy isn't something which is particularly new or novel or should not shock anyone. It is true that countries which are authoritarian do advance more because there is centralized authority, and once a decision is taken, the decision is taken. There is no time or resources expended trying to then explain it, to modify it. Imagine, if you will, any modern company which is run through democracy. It isn't, right? The CEO takes a decision.
Right, absolutely.
Good or bad, he takes a decision with the board, five people. But it's got, like, if you have 100, 10,000, 20,000 employees, they don't go and ask the 10,000, 20,000 employees that we're going to divest this, or we're going to acquire this, or we're going to, you know, cut off 10% of our workforce. If they see, no company, if you go and ask people, can we fire you? And people will say, yeah, please do, please do. Nobody's going to say that, right? And the reason why corporations are not democracies is because they have to make a profit. That's why. You cannot have democracy and also expect that the country will do taraki, the country will do this, the country will do that, and it'll happen fast. No, that won't happen. If you look at India and if you look at US, it's the same thing. These are two of the most democratic countries. And of course, US has had huge advantages. That's why US is still so far ahead. But over the past few years, this has been a problem that many American commentators have commented on. The fact that the US politics, ever since Bill Clinton, has been plagued by a sense of political deadlock. Nothing big can happen in Washington, D.C., because the other side, whoever the other side is, just won't let it happen. So when you have something like Obamacare, which is a once-in-a-generation thing, which is a major change that happens once in a generation, it still isn't what it could have been. And it's what happened. What Obamacare was ultimately a massive dilution of what the original vision of Obamacare was. Now, would that original vision have been better or worse? We don't know. But the fact is that the watered-down version that currently exists is just that. It is kind of doomed to failure. And this is exactly what happens in a democracy, that because of the so-called vibrancy of a democracy, no decision can be taken that inconveniences a significant section of people. Now, somebody would say that's exactly why democracy exists, and that is a good thing. That and I'm fine with that. But then you cannot then have expectations that why isn't our GDP growing? Why isn't this happening? Why isn't this happening? Why aren't there reforms in the farming sector? Yeah, this is exactly what happens when you have reforms in the farming sector. Now, when the Communist Party when the CPM government took over Bengal and they wanted to reform, what they did was essentially, they didn't care for democracy. They basically went in and said that anybody who has this amount of land will just grab it from them. That's it. Fuck you. You don't like it? Then we'll send, you know, our carriers to beat you up, and then you'll say, okay. So which one do you want? Now, at that point of time, since it was the CPM, none of the democratic institutions inside the idea of India were activated. Nobody gave a flying fuck. Whether it was the tyranny of distance, or as Abhinandan Sekri said on this show, nobody cares for Bengal, whatever it be. The fact is, nobody did. So the West Bengal government was able to achieve land reforms, which some people said was the biggest achievement, positive achievement of the West Bengal government, the West Bengal Communist Party of India government, Jyoti Basu's government. Now, it was an achievement, true, when it comes to looking at overall numbers, overall statistics, but definitely wasn't particularly good for the people who actually had the land. It wasn't good for them. They lost stuff which they had. I mean, somebody comes and says, I'm going to take your iPhone now. You can either give it to me now, or I'll send 100 people who will stand outside your house and pee on your door and then come and break in your door and, you know, rearrange your nose. And then you can give them your iPhone, or you can give it to me now. So this might be good for the collection of iPhones by the state, but it might not be good for you who bought the iPhone. So the thing is that any kind of, I honestly don't understand the shock and why Amitabh Kant had to roll back. Is like, I didn't say it. Yeah, sure. Too much democracy is a problem. It is an impediment to development. Now, you can say that this is a cost that we are okay with. We are okay with it, because otherwise, and that is the valid argument, I would say, that we are okay with it. But the problem is, you can't expect both. Like, again, as an example, Germany advanced from being an absolute wreck after World War I to essentially flattening Europe in 12 years. Under who? Right, exactly. We don't want that kind of development, right? We don't want that kind of development at that cost. But yeah, he did it. He took a country which had been humiliated, split, its industry destroyed. He took it from that, absolutely militarily defeated, and he took it to that, and he just basically flattened Europe within 12 years. And it's not just a question of military might. I mean, it was technological might. I mean, the German Air Force, I mean, they were unleashing the kind of technology that nobody had seen before. And the reason why ultimately one of the reasons the World War was won was because Europe couldn't match Germany's technological capability. America could. It is America which came in and saved the day, because America was the only other country which was investing and was doing that level of technological development. And ultimately, it essentially made the atom bomb. I mean, that was really, really ended this war. After that, there would be no world war. One side has that. Well, what are you going to do? So the fact is, again, that the advancement of, and as a matter of fact, now many people will say, what about US? US has always been a vibrant democracy. No, US, the reason why US was able, there were a lot of other reasons. First of all, US was a very vast country with very few people. Second was that US had institutionalized slavery, which was the worst form of fascism. The people were things. And this country, essentially the huge growth, the huge momentum that it had was because, for a large degree, because of slavery. So you cannot also say that US is a successful democracy. No. Yes, it was a democracy, but it was a democracy for white people only. It wasn't a democracy. So,
and not for women also, for quite...
Not for women also for a long time. And it definitely, it grew off the absolute free labor from black people who were captured from Africa and brought in chains. So that is the legacy of US. That is how the US became a superpower in the world. That's their, you know, well-known dirty secret. So even the US didn't become, I mean, of course, I'm not saying this is the only reason, but this is one of the big reasons why the US is what it is today. And now that the US no longer has that power, fortunately, the US's power is on the decline. And whose power is on the ascent? China, where there is basically no human rights, where there is no dissent. So power, which other countries have a lot of money? Saudi Arabia has a lot of money. Guess what's common to Saudi Arabia and China? So you cannot have a lot of prosperity, a lot of growth without also having some form or an all-pervasive form of authoritarianism. They just do not mix. So again, it is a good thing to say, look, we don't want growth. We don't want affluence at that cost. And that is a perfectly moral thing to say. And that's exactly what I would say, that we don't need it. Sure, we take this compromise that we don't want a Hitler to take us from where we are to a first world country. By the way, this is the same thing Stalin did. Stalin took, the erstwhile USSR, which was at that point of time the poorest country in Europe. Enormous amount of poverty. If you've read the works of Russian novelists in the early 19th century, it's all about extreme poverty. He took a country which was so vast, so diverse. It was immensely diverse. Like the only other country that comes even close to its diversity is India. It was an extremely diverse country, huge country, which was poor, uneducated, primarily agrarian, very divided. And he took it, and within 20 years, he made it into the world's second superpower. Again, who's the guy? Stalin. So this level of this kind of revolutionary move forward, this kind of ascendancy to the world, the topper echelons of world power, these do not happen just like that. They don't happen with dissent, because they will inevitably lead to, in case of Hitler, in case of Stalin, it's very obvious whose interests were compromised. So coming back to the farmers thing, whatever you think, whether the farmers are justified or not, as I've said multiple times, that there is no good, that I have still to find some good reason as to why what is wrong with the farmers' bill. By the way, all political parties have advocated for it when they were in power. It's just that nobody had the balls to do anything about it except the BJP. And the reason why the BJP has the balls to do anything about it is right now they're no longer in Punjab directly. And also because they're politically in a state where they can now take that risk, which is a good thing. If you can't take a risk now, when are you going to take a risk? So this is, again, I saw a tweet from Prithish Nandi, which said, here's one thing. If this was so good for farmers, why are farmers against it? The fact is that, here's the answer, Mr. Nandi. See, the thing is, it's not, you're right, it's not good for farmers as in, it is good for the farmer class in general, not for the people who currently occupy that layer of privilege. So yes, this is something which is making it disruptive. It is good for farming in general by providing more options, but it's definitely not good for the people who are currently occupy the top creamy layer of farming. No. And in any other, if this was any other issue, if it was not the BJP government, this would have been lauded, because it was essentially democratizing Indian farming. It is bringing it out of the clutches of the middlemen, all of whom are rich farmers, as I said in a previous podcast. That this is primarily also not even a protest of all farmers. It's a protest of farmers in Punjab, which is almost 100% MSP dependent for their lifestyles. So this is a small section of farmers who have inordinately benefited from essentially free money, that who are now protesting. Now they have every right to protest. There's no reason why. And people would say, well, what about middle class? Of course, everybody gets something from the Indian state. Now, farmers, especially the big farmers in Punjab, they have been untouchable since independence. Even Narasimha Rao couldn't touch them because of the amount of money and power that they have. And it has led, I mean, this You know, this is not just a question of farming. This is responsible for a whole lot of other problems in Punjab. Essentially, the drug problem, everything. There's not much for people to do, for young people to do, because there's money coming in. There's always money coming in because of big farming there. And what this legislation is, it's not even to break it up. It's providing a means for competition. There's no guarantee that will come to pass. It could very well be that these are not pervasive enough, that the farm bills actually don't lead to anything, in which case the farmers are protesting for nothing. They're going to lead their cushy lives. They're going to get their MSPs. And the government has repeatedly said, we are not going away with MSPs. Now, of course, ultimate end game chronology samjhe is they will get rid of it. But right now, they aren't. And so ultimately, we get to all these, you know, why are the farmers protesting? Of course, some farmers are protesting because it will lead to a loss of privilege for them. Ambani, this will help the Ambanis. This will help the Adanis. Yeah, sure. It will help the Ambanis. It will help the Adanis. But is the reason for not doing something, it won't help them? Because right now, the way Ambani is, anything will help him. Like you can say, oh, Rohit Sharma recovered from his hamstring injury. This will help the Ambanis. Let's go and break his leg. So right now, this is that kind of logic here. So the fact is, Ambani is so positioned that anything will benefit them. So that is not a reason enough to say, let's not do this because it will benefit Ambanis. Because ultimately, the logic that I see comes to that. Which brings me to the last point in this too much democracy thing. See, the problem with another big problem with democracy is a two-way street. It's also contingent on the citizenry to do their research on things. I mean, there is no reason why people are confused as to the farm bill, at least those of us who can read and who can use the internet. There are a lot of very good explainers in video, you know, in text, this podcast, which explains what the farm bill is. So the fact is that most people don't really care. They want to listen to what Priyanka Chopra says or what Saurabh Bhaskar says. And that's really where they get their news from. That's where they get their opinions from, I'm sorry. And when too much democracy is also the fact is that people, when they take an opinion on something, they're guided not by facts, but they're guided by immense laziness, I would say. That too much democracy also to me means that it's not a problem with democracy, but democracy also, as I said, there's a responsibility on you as a citizen of a democracy to do your due diligence, to do your own edification. Now, in the 80s and the 90s, it just wasn't possible. It was just not possible to know everything about the issues because the things were just not available. The only source of information we had was government-controlled Doordarshan and some newspapers. So we could not study. But that is no longer your excuse. You have the entire human knowledge is now available for free, essentially, online. So you can find it out. So another problem with democracy is that people don't take or make the effort to educate themselves, that they depend on Kunal Kamra or Scoop Hoop to digest and then, you know, digest the news and then pass them that gruel, that they're not willing to use their own intellectual digestive juices to break down food into nutrition. They want pre-digested food to be given to them like an invalid. And that's really the problem with Indian democracy. There's a problem with US democracy also, by the way. And this was, again, this is not new. This is what, again, Plato said, you know, thousands of years ago, that most people are stupid and they will just go based on some other pre-digested stuff somebody gives them just because it conforms to their biases and their interests. And they don't really understand what, and that's why he wanted a separate educated ruling class, is that there isn't, you know, most people, they can't think of the big picture. They'll just think, okay, if I am a person who's in farming, then yeah, of course, I'm not going to be against MSPs. Will that help the country? Would it, from a country perspective, is this a good use of people's tax rupees? Could the government spend this money, for instance, on really helping poor farmers? I don't really care. So too much democracy is a very nice, that's why I like the word too much democracy. Yeah, I think we have too much democracy. Now, is it a problem? Should it be changed? No. But to an extent, yes. It's not, let's have too little democracy isn't the solution. The solution is for us to be a more engaged citizenry, to take advantage of the different resources that are available and not just to go on like 5-minute digests. And even what I say, I'm also digesting stuff. So if this is the only source that you use to form your opinions, then you're also being infinitely lazy.
Right.
So I'm doing the same thing. But for me, what I do is that I consume pre-digested gruel from multiple sources. That helps me. And then when they link to original things, like, for instance, the Niti Aayog report on MSPs, I go ahead and read it. See, that's the difference. And then I say, yeah, I know. Yeah, this, not that I understand everything, not that I have the intellectual tools or the patience to understand everything, but I generally get a good idea that, okay, I think I get what they're saying here. And so, for instance, one of the pieces which supported the government's stance said that, according to Niti Aayog, 100% of farmers in Punjab use MSP. Now, when you read the report, you realize that's not true either. According to a survey that they did, 100% did. That's not, doesn't mean that 100% of farmers use MSP. So even that, it's not right. This is based on a sampling that they did. Yeah, 100% did. This is a sample. And they were like, did a sampling of Gujarat, 40% or 50% did. Yes, it does show that a greater proportion of people in Punjab use MSP because of the way the crops are skewed there. Yes. But that doesn't mean if you just read it and say, there's nobody in Punjab who doesn't use. No, that's not the case either. So, that's why it's very important for anybody to, and I'm not saying that I really care for many issues. For instance, I really don't care who wins Big Boss 14. I really don't. So I'm not going to be doing original research there. I really don't care. But if it's something which you as somebody who cares, then too much democracy is when you get it from Kunal Kamra or when you get it from Dhruv Rathi. See, that's where the problem is.
Hey, what do you want to watch on TV?
What do you want to watch?
I don't know. What do you want to watch?
What do...
Spending more time deciding what to watch than actually watching? Here's help. Binge On is a podcast that has theme-based recommendations on stuff to watch online across Netflix, Amazon, Prime, Hotstar, Disney+, Apple TV, YouTube, and a whole lot more.
Comedies, horror movies, documentaries, love stories, web series, regional Indian language, and lots more. Binge On has recommendations for you. Head over to forspire.net to subscribe using the podcast app of your choice.
All right. So the next thing that I want to talk about was future of movies. You want to set that up?
I was wondering how we are going to segue into the next topic. But yes.
We just an abrupt movement. It's not going to segue into it.
Yes, no need to do a fine shift. But yes, earlier this week, we did have this news that who owns Warner now? It's AT&T. So they mentioned that all the major Warner movies. So we've got the new Wonder Woman movie coming out on Christmas. That's going to release not just in theaters, but also on HBO Max, which is their streaming service. And they also said that next year, all their major movies will also release directly on OTT or on streaming. So basically, you did write about this. I mean, your point being that, this is probably making it more democratic. I mean, yeah, that should have been a good segue. Speaking of democratization, let me redo the entire bit now. Yeah, speaking of democratization, so how is this going to be, movie viewing is going to get more democratic, wouldn't it?
Yes. So, for me, going to a movie is now actually let me put it this way. Going to the movies is a privilege that very few people in the world have. Because if you're affluent, then yes, you can go to the movies. It's not just a question of the money it takes. I mean, there's a significant, movie ticket prices everywhere. And it's not just in India, it's in the US too. Movie ticket prices have increased way more than inflation. When I was in college, you could watch a movie, not at the best ticket, but you could definitely watch a decent movie for 20 rupees. Okay. I'm not talking in the front. I'm not talking in the balcony where you... So you could watch it in a decent movie, a Gupta or something, I paid 20 rupees to watch it. So obviously, and what is the price of a ticket now?
Close to 200 bucks, give or take. I believe in Delhi, it's a lot more. But yeah, 200, 250 would be a average price in a multiplex now.
Now, in those days, going to the multiplex wasn't also about... Like the ticket nowadays, the cost of going to a multiplex, the ticket is a small part of it. There is popcorn and everything else which you have to freaking
right
buy.
From parking.
Excuse me?
Parking. The mall parking itself.
Mall parking. In those days, of course, there was no parking. Nobody had cars. Everybody went by bus. So that was okay. But anyway. And also the thing was that food in single screen wasn't a big deal at all. The food was cheap. When we used to see, firstly, as college kids, we didn't have food at the theater. But even if we wanted to have food at the theater, it was basically oily chips, like real indigestion triggers and jaundice for 1 rupee. That's what we used to get.
Yes.
Now, this is not the single screen. There was no business model for the food and the drinks. There were people who used from outside who used to come in during the interval and sell. They would possibly give some cut to the guy sitting in the front. But this would all be, this would not be the corporatized structure that it is now in multiplexes in the US. I mean, that's the model is the US model, where you are basically charged three times what you would pay. And there is like, as somebody joked, that the guys who stand in these movie theaters checking for your bags so that you're not smuggling in fruit should actually be at the airport, because they do a much better job of ensuring that you're not carrying anything in than the security at the airport. So the cost of going to the multiplex has become prohibitively expensive. And it's not just the cost of the things you buy, but it's the availability of that time. The 2 hours watching a movie, then an hour, let's say the whole 4 hour thing. To get those 4 hours for you and your family, when you have both the husband and the wife working, when you have kids, it is just not something which is possible anymore. And it requires people with a very high amount of privilege to be able to adjust their quote unquote calendars to even accommodate a night out with the family to the theater. This is true in India. This is true in the US. If you have movies which are being streamed directly to through online streaming platforms, and I'm not saying that the only alternative is to have them as part of, let's say, a streaming service. You can have pay-per-view. You can have the exact same model that you do at the cinema, except you do it at home. In the cinema, if you pay, say, $10, then a movie at home, you pay $5 and everybody gets to watch. But the good thing about this is that this allows people to not allocate a contiguous period of time. So if the husband can watch the movie at one time. The wife can watch it at another time. They don't necessarily have to sit and watch it at the same time. They can watch it in small increments. Like me and my wife, we can't sit through any movie nowadays from start to finish. Hey, it'll obviously be stopped, paused. There'll be something which has to be done. And only then we can come in and watch. So, you know, you can't do that in, you know, you can't do that if you're going to the movie. I mean, my wife and I haven't been to the movies for a long time. And we can go to the movies only when my parents come from India. It's the only time my wife and I can go to the movies if it's not a children's movie. So we just can't. So the fact that otherwise Hollywood, which is so fixated on removing privilege and promoting diversity, that they would oppose something which is possibly the most fundamental move that enables the breaking down of privilege and promotes diversity. Because I'm pretty sure if you conduct, you know, a survey, you'll see that there will be specific kind of people who, based on the function of their privilege, who are able to go to theaters more than some other people. So this is what, and given the low cost of internet, and given that these streaming platforms are competitively priced, this allows more people to enjoy movies. And if the question is monetization, then yeah, I mean, as I said, it doesn't necessarily have to be that you do it with you know, Netflix or with, right, in this case, HBO Max. Now, here, the problem is that here, this is a specific reason why people are pissed off with AT&T. Because AT&T has started HBO Max. HBO Max is a streaming service which is really the HBO TV channel with some other exclusive content for HBO Max. This is their competition to Netflix. So HBO, for those of you who don't know, HBO has been really the original Netflix. So HBO has been there for, I don't know how many decades. I know that in the 80s when my parents came to HBO used to exist. So HBO was a premium, it was a television channel which was the most expensive to subscribe to. They showed, you know, fairly new movies, 5 or 6 months old movies. And they also made their own TV series and their own movies, which were different and considered to be more prestige and arty because they were more big budget than what was made in, let's say, the main channels. So because they were based on a separate subscription model, they could invest in making more risky stories, which would possibly be more arty and everything. So this was considered to be prestige TV. Now, Netflix started off as, didn't start off as a content provider. It started off as basically a DVD mailer, and then later on an online streaming service which just streamed other people's movies. It was with, I think, with Stranger Things, if I'm not wrong, that they started.
No, it was the president thing. What is that?
The one with Kevin Spacey.
Kevin Spacey one, yeah.
Yeah, that was the first time that they decided to produce original content. So that was when they basically made a direct, and see, because of the amount of cash that they were now sitting on, they had the investment, they had the actual cash available to invest in these big prestige projects. So they began taking on HBO. So even though HBO had like Game of Thrones and stuff, I mean, they still, you know, some of the biggest budget TV series ever made. The thing is that HBO felt that it's no longer, and HBO, by the way, is backed by AT&T and it is allied with Warner Brothers, so that they're kind of losing to Netflix. Now, Netflix's early moving advantage was that Netflix essentially owned the technological platform. Their main innovation was to do video streaming at that scale. Now, sooner or later, that technological advantage has gone away. Now, essentially, you get those kinds of services as if almost as a freebie from Amazon Web, I mean, from AWS, from any cloud service. They provide you essentially that level of streaming as a service. So you could just as well take your, if you have a catalog of movies, you could just go, you know, go to AWS, get a developer, work on a front end, and start and become your own Netflix. So the focus has now moved from the technology to the content. Now, of course, Netflix was smart enough to realize that, so it took a head start, and it has made up a huge amount of Netflix content. But this was the time in which, for instance, Disney realized, hey, why do we let Netflix stream our Marvel movies? That's our stuff. Right. So that's why Marvel, you know, they took out Marvel from Friends. They lost Friends. They lost Marvel. They lost the whole Marvel franchise. And Disney and Disney started their own streaming service because the technology wasn't a problem. Disney said, and rightfully understood, that we have the core IP for Star Wars and for Marvel. Why should we let these other guys make money from it? Warner Brothers realized, oh, we have the IP for DC. Why should we let anybody else make money for this? And why isn't HBO, which we own, why isn't that making money from this? So with respect to Wonder Woman, it's not such a so big a problem because ultimately everything there is ultimately the same ownership. The problem is with other movies that they are planning to stream directly when it is released. So one of the reasons why people are so pissed isn't because of the money, because the actors and everybody, it's based on the contract they signed. And I know this because I signed contracts for these kind of acquisitions myself. So I know how these contracts are usually structured. So some people, like some big actors, they sometimes might have some stake in the box office. So they can say, okay, I'll take 1% of whatever the box office earnings is on top of my fees. That's like kind of my bonus. But the thing is, if Warner Brothers has decided to make this move, I'm pretty sure they have thought through all of these implications. They have escape clauses in their contracts, or they can restructure their contracts to make sure that these people are compensated. They have their ways of doing this. And again, they're not, it's not an asymmetric battle. If you are Christopher Nolan, and you are, you know, Christopher Nolan is well equipped to take on a Warner Brothers. And it's not just Christopher Nolan, it's like 100 Christopher Nolans on, and that's really, for those of you who don't know, the Hollywood system is a little different from Bollywood. In Bollywood, essentially the strength, the unit of strength is the star's coterie. So you have the Salman Khan coterie, Salman Khan group, you have the Shah Rukh Khan group. And when new actors or actresses come into, they attach themselves to one of these circles. That's how they get their jobs. That's how they get their power. Ultimately, when they become powerful enough, they develop their own circle. That's why this, and this is kind of was linked to the whole Sushant Singh Rajput thing. The Sushant Singh Rajput found out that he was not becoming part of any of these circles. And that's where he felt frustrated. And he's expressed that multiple times. He expressed that. So, and of course, Karan Johar is again a huge circle master. And that's where his influence comes from, because he's kind of the central ring of all of these circles. So that's why he has inordinate amount of influence. Now, in Hollywood, in the 90s, or in the 20s and 30s, there were these big studios like Warner Brothers, you know, MGM, and they were the stars. So the again, there was a huge, the stars of the actors, but there was this huge asymmetry in power. So the stars were not powerful at all. Even the big stars, they were just one individual. I mean, a Clark Gable could be replaced by somebody else. I mean, they had their names, but they were they didn't have the resources, for instance, that an MGM had. So what happened was many of these stars, they were locked into contracts, which were extremely, and this was not just in Hollywood, this was also in the music industry. So when a new star was discovered, they would basically make that guy become a slave. They would say, okay, we will launch you in this movie, but you will have to sign a 5-picture exclusive deal at the rate of today, or maybe 10% more. And then after a movie, you know, movie takes off, you become a superstar. And then for 5 more movies, you're working for this studio for peanuts because you're contractually obligated. Now, this is where the mafia started coming in. So the stars then went to the mafia. So if you remember, if you've read Godfather, one of the side stories in Godfather is essentially this singer called Johnny Fontaine.
Yeah, yeah.
That's exactly the thing. Johnny Fontaine is signed on to a contract.
Yes, which he needs to get out of.
Yes, and that's when the father's, when Don Corleone says, either your brains or your signature will be on this. you release him from the contract. So that's how the mafia started coming in, because there was the only way you can get out of these contracts was from the business end of a gun. Now, of course, people soon realize that when you bring the mafia in, it works both ways, that the mafia will also ask you to do something for them at some point of time. So that's when the studio system started taking, that's when the agent system started taking off, in Hollywood. So within a few years, there were four or five of these huge agencies that represented. They were essentially, think of them as unions, but they were agency. These agencies represented the stars. So stars became part of these agencies. And so one of the biggest agency was, for instance, Creative Artists Agency, which I've been fortunate to have been represented once for mine. So these agencies now started representing, and the things about these agencies was that you couldn't go to these agencies. These agencies came to you. So they signed you up when they felt that you had promise and that you would, that's when they signed you up. So these agencies who themselves, because of the power of the different people that they have, and they were also taking a cut out of whatever you're getting, they then had the influence to represent the stars. So when you have somebody like Warner Brothers doing this, they essentially go up against all these agencies. So if you look through the whatever writing, you'll see that a lot of these agents are basically saying, you know, we'll fuck you up, Warner Brothers, if you try to do this. Because it's not the stars, it's the agents who are really, think of them as like union reps who represent the stars. So these guys have money, they have muscle, they have lawyers, they can go toe-to-toe with these big studios.
But tell me something. For Hollywood at least, unlike in India, where of course it's still changing quite a bit, but the big stars have never really shied away from television, right? Even for in these made for TV movies produced by HBO or Netflix, you've had big stars come in. So what is it that's holding them back now? See, why are they shying away from releasing a movie, let's say, even on pay-per-view?
So it's not so much the stars. So there is a few things. So first, stars who have contracts which are tied to the commercial successes of the movies, there might be some hesitance in translating what that means when it is pay-per-view or when it is streaming. Now,
it's
when Martin's
transparent,
they don't know what the formula is. So this is a kind of teething problem. So they said, okay, wait, for 40 years, this is the way I've been paid. Now you're saying I'm going to get paid per clicks. How does that work? You know, it's not transparent to me. So one of the reasons is that. The second thing I don't think is that so much. I don't think that at this point of time, Tom Hanks and these guys really care. I don't know, the big guys. I don't think Robert De Niro is sitting there and like poring over Excel sheets. For instance, I think much of the blowback is coming not from so much from the stars, but from the directors. And this is coming because of there is the prestige, which is associated with the theatrical release. And this, I think, will change over the years. There are some directors, like definitely Christopher Nolan, who think that it is a lesser thing to have something to be shown on streaming.
Yeah, and I'm sure Tarantino would never make a movie for Netflix.
So there are many directors who have this almost ideological aversion to TV. So they think this is a lesser medium. And I don't make it for TV. So that's just there. And in the US, there's always been this. It's a standing joke that, you know, when movies don't do well, they call it direct to video. Like they make it direct to video.
Right,
so
exactly.
There's always this, and all of these people grew up with that, right? So anything which goes direct to video, there's automatically a presumption that it is not of good quality. And so that is what they're fighting against. I mean, I think the most similar thing that I can think of this in book publishing is self-publishing. like most authors, like even I hesitate to self-publish because I feel that self-publishing means that it's a sign of poor quality. When I grew up, any self-published book means the guy was, that book is so pathetic that it's not going to be published by anybody. So he has to publish it himself. Like, what a desperate nut. Now, that's no longer the case because the reason is, and that's no longer the case because the publishers are also publishing the exact same book. Once that book becomes popular, they will publish that same so-called shit book. And the publishers, and that's I know from dealing with them, is they're no better. You know, they work based on politics. They work based on, you know, they work based on a lot of factors, which have got absolutely nothing to do with quality. Absolutely nothing to do with quality. So as a matter of fact, you know, if you self-publish, if you do it on Amazon, you as a reader are more likely to get good work than when it's filtered through publishers who in India especially have zero idea of the genre. So you have the same publisher who edits, who evaluates romances, mysteries, horror. I mean, how could one person understand all of these genres? I mean, I would never, as an editor, would never take on a romantic comedy. For instance, I don't even get that. I wouldn't know the first thing about what's good or what's bad. And all books that are romantic comedy, I hate. So what am I going to do about it? So in India, that's the thing. You have people who are reviewing horror who don't like horror. And they review horror. And they try to find romantic comedy inside horror. So if there's a romantic comedy which is horror, they'll choose it. So this is the kind of fucked up stuff that comes out of quote-unquote brand name publishers. So that presumption is not true. Even, but having said that, even in 2020, I look at somebody who's self-publishing and the first thing that comes to my head is loser. Even now, even after knowing all of this, this is what I think. And I'm trying to self-publish my own book. And I think this myself. So what does this say for the level of conditioning that we have? So if I can't get rid of this, me, how can I expect anybody else to get rid of this? This is, I think, exactly what work goes through the minds of a Christopher Nolan. Of course, I'm a Nolan Gu Sandesh compared to the great Christopher Nolan. But you can imagine the amount of ego that he has and how and what a huge, huge slap in the face it is for him that, you know, Tenet was a box office failure, right? Big. Yes. Time doctor. I mean, much of this is happening because of Tenet, because Christopher Nolan chose to show Tenet at a time in the theaters. It was based on his superstar ego and his influence that they released it in theaters at a time when COVID was raging everywhere, which I felt was an extremely poor reflection on Christopher Nolan as a human being, that he would put people's lives in danger because of his ego. And it was a monstrous failure. It's not helped by the fact that the movie itself is not that good, apparently. And also the fact that you cannot release a movie in this day and age. I think what Warner Brothers is doing is the more humane thing to do. You can either delay your big movies for 1 year or 1.5 years, or this is what you have to do for 2021. I fully support what Warner Brothers is doing, by the way.
Let me ask you this then. How do you see this translating to India? Do you see a Bhai movie, let's say, releasing on Hotstar the same day as it's in theaters?
No, I mean, it's already happened, right? You have the Akshay Kumar, who's pretty big.
Yeah, sure. But do you see that? That was more of an exception, right? You still won't have a Suryavanshi, for example, releasing.
With Bhai movies, the problem with Bhai movies is that, you know, see, the Bhai is not a movie.
Bhai is an experience.
Bhai is an experience. I was going to say Bhai is an orgy, but let's just call Bhai is an experience.
Similarly, so down south, I don't think I can expect one of the superstar movies or to ever release directly. And in fact, just going back,
They should delay. So the fact is that there are some movies whose experiencing is not because of the cinematic qualities of what is being shown on screen, but because of the group experience of watching it in a theater, right? See, that's right. The difference between Tenet and, let's say, I don't know, I can't think of anything in Hollywood which has that kind of thing. But Tenet is not a movie which you need to see in the theater, other than the fact that, okay, it's the action sequences and stuff. Other than that, there's no fan thing going on there.
Right. It's not Avengers Endgame.
It's not Avengers Endgame, which it comes close, but even Avengers Endgame doesn't come close to a Bhai release or a Rajinikanth release. Or, you know, this is something else. This is like a devotional thing, right?
True. In fact, just going back 10 years, I remember when Kamal Haasan released Viswarupam, his original plan was to make it a DTH release. He wanted to release on pay-per-view on all the DTH platforms because, in fact, he made the same points that you did, saying that, you know, in this day and age, I think it's very difficult for families to go out and watch. And he did this. And of course, there was a huge hue and cry. And then the theater owners said that, you know, we are going to boycott you, blah, blah, blah. And then he had to back down and release his movie in theaters.
Yeah, so I think the only thing that I have an issue with Warner Brothers is that they should have made it pay-per-view. They shouldn't be... They're basically releasing it on HBO Max for free because they are essentially using that to promote HBO Max. So HBO Max's subscription is going to go through the roof next year if this happens, right? Because you're going to be able to see all Warner Brothers movies on the day of its release. So this is a valid problem that some may have, and that they're seeing that they're using one side of the business to subsidize the other side of the business. That's the only quote-unquote unethical thing that one could think of. So it's not the question of whether they're showing it as streaming. It's a question of, you know, that they're using it as a way to promote HBO Max and for HBO Max to take on Netflix. I mean, I'm pretty sure that at the end of next year, if they actually go through with this, HBO Max will be the size of Netflix, the kind of releases they will be having first day, first show on it. And there's no reason for at least me to go to the theaters next year at all if this comes to true, because I have HBO Max. So I'll see it there.
Right. Is that our podcast for today?
That is our podcast for today. Hi.
And of course, one thing you can always do from the comfort of your home or while you're walking, wearing a mask, is listen to a podcast. You never have to go to a theater and do that. So we hope you did. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Please leave your comments as usual on the Twitter page. And remember, once again, a reminder about hashtag Ask Arnab Ray. And do we have this on Facebook as well, Arnab? Or is it only on Twitter?
Oh, yeah, Facebook, Facebook asking questions on my, for those of you, my Facebook friends, I mean, sure, ask me questions.
You do have a Great Bonk page, don't you?
I do have, but I'm not particularly, okay, yeah, I don't particularly engage with people. Ultimately, if I'm lazy, I do it on my own personal. So, you know, I prefer Twitter for these things, or you can email me, or you can contact Vikram.
Absolutely. You can.
You have a WhatsApp for this, right? Or something?
No, we don't have a WhatsApp anymore, but you can email us at appodcast@forespire.net, or even leave a comment on the website. You'll have the link in the show notes. So until next time, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. How long was that?